All right. Hello and welcome to the Mobility Podcast. I'm Greg Rogers with Securing America's Future Energy, and I have my fantastic co-host with me. I didn't say lovely this time. Is that okay, Pete?
Yeah, I feel less assaulted. Pete Gould with Shared Mobility Strategies.
His hair does look really good today, so maybe we should say lovely.
Yeah, we're in stiff competition.
I hope it look better than
because you have more hairspray.
Anyways, I'm Greg Rodriguez, and as always, views are our own.
Great, and we are recording from the Transportation Research Board's annual meeting. Today we're joined by Laura Schuhl from Streetlight Data.
Hello.
Hello, and thanks for welcoming us. Can you start off, I guess, by telling folks what Streetlight Data is, for those who aren't familiar, and how you came to be sort of doing this? Also, before you start, you had a fantastic TED Talk. So everyone, after you listen to this episode, I highly recommend checking it out.
Thanks. Yeah. So I'm Laura. I'm the CEO of Streetlight Data. Streetlight Data is a software that is used by people in the transportation industry. So our clients could be a government agency. They could be an engineering or consulting firm. They could be a private mobility, new mobility company. And all of them need to know some fundamental facts about what's happening on the roads, on the lanes, on the bike paths, etc. So we provide data about your classic transportation engineering questions, origin, destination, select, link, AADT. We also provide some more interesting analytics, like how many people driving down this road are tourists versus locals? Are they going to home? Are they going to work? How many times a week do they do that? Are they on a bike? Are they on a car? And the way we're able to make all that data available with just a few clicks in our software is by leveraging the fact that there's been an explosion of mobile devices in the world. Everyone is walking around with an incredibly powerful sensor in their pocket in the form of their smartphone. All modern cars and trucks have GPS tracking capabilities, and a lot of our new mobility options have GPS on board as well. So we license data from millions and millions of those devices in a privacy-appropriate way and aggregate, enrich, and interpret it so that our clients can quickly get answers to mobility questions.
Very cool.
Was that brief enough?
Yeah, no, I think that's perfect.
Sure. And
so obviously the word data is everywhere now. I mean, I remember what 5 years ago at TRB when it was automated vehicles, and those are still standing room only, but now we have complicated issues like spectrum coming into the limelight, and now we have mobility data and privacy, and I think we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But I want to go back to something I think you were starting to allude to with us carrying these powerful devices that can track us and everything around sensitive geolocation data, all these new studies that are coming out to say how people can be re-identified. In my mind, we're at this tipping point where we really need to start thinking about trust. Mm-hmm. As we collect more and more data about citizens or users of smart mobility. And it seems like, we've been talking about longevity a little bit on the podcast recently as we think about seeing some smart mobility providers unfortunately go away for whatever reason. But we had Zipcar on recently. They're just celebrating their 20th anniversary. You all have been in the business for a number of years.
Eight years.
And have been navigating some of these tricky issues like data and privacy. How have you been able to do that, and how important do you think trust is moving forward?
Oh, I think it is the critical question. So you're correct that we've seen the demise of a lot of new mobility providers. We've also seen the demise, or sort of, we call it recapitalization or pivoting, of startups in the mobility analytics space in the past year. A lot of the ones that came up in my generation of transportation tech startups. So for us, there's two people whom we need to be trusted by. The first is our clients, the governments, the engineering firms, etc. And the second are the people who provide us data via their mobile devices or connected vehicles. And there is often tension between maintaining trust between those two parties. And that walking that line is our job. So in terms of privacy in general, we decided very early on that, because we all wanted to work at a company we were proud of, that privacy was going to be part of our brand from day one. And so our first hire was a VP of privacy, a professional. That is a job, right? There are professional privacy experts and corporate privacy officers. So we have one. Her name is Kara. She's amazing.
Wealth of knowledge.
Yes.
I will second her wealth of knowledge.
Yes.
Amazing.
She will talk your ear off about it in a good way.
And enjoys it.
Yes. And it's not cheap if you're a startup to have a full-time senior level VP, and part of her job is flying around the world. She participates in Future of Privacy Forum, Association of Privacy Professionals. FCC calls meetings of experts, and she goes. So that is, just cash-wise, a big initial investment we made in privacy. So we would know what was coming. We'd help make the conversation responsible about privacy and data. And also so we could show our clients and our investors and our users that this really is something we care about. So that's how we've done it from a brand perspective. And that, for a long time, people thought we were silly. We have turned down millions of dollars of work where the client asked us to give them individualized trip traces, right? This happens all the time, and it used to happen more. And we're like, no, we only give aggregated data that we have tested mathematically and feel that it is almost impossible to re-identify an individual. You can't say impossible because math, but pretty much impossible to re-identify an individual coming from this. And so we feel that there's this trend in transportation, especially in the first 5 years of our company, to think only about the perfect answer from transportation's perspective. And our clients say, oh, you got to be transparent. You got to give us the raw data, and then we'll redo all the aggregation and make sure you were right. We're like, we understand how that would build your trust as a client, but we cannot violate the trust of the individuals who created this data and the other companies we bought this data from. Our licenses prevent us from giving that individualized data, and that's really important. So talking our clients through that process and trying to explain, we will tell you very transparently our methods, we will allow you to do validation studies on the aggregate, but we cannot give you this disaggregated data. We stick very hard to that line, and we've lost a lot of money from it in the past 8 years. But now that awareness of privacy is becoming more sort of a layperson's awareness is rising, and that means that the elected officials' awareness is rising, that means that the directors of the Department of Transportation awareness is rising, we see it paying off. We're not quite to the point where all of the analysts will be satisfied with our answers, and we keep on having this trust conversation where we're balancing the two trusts, but it's moving forward, and I think we'll end up in a place where we realize that there have to be methodologies by which you are assured that data is both accurate, but also that it is protected. So our approach is pretty straightforward. We just do these big validation studies, and then we just put them all online.
So from, you know, stepping back a couple steps to that individual with the iPhone, is there an opt-in on this kind of data world that
yes.
is, you know, yeah, I get it's being anonymized, but like at what point did the general public say, sure?
Did I click accept on that?
You did.
I probably did.
Anybody in Streetlight opted in.
I don't remember reading that.
As opposed to opted out. And so that's a big difference between back in the day of big data. Big data for transportation might have come from telcos. And that system traditionally was opt out, which means by signing your contract, you opted in. And then you had to go through a whole process to opt out. One of the reasons we switched to using data from a variety of smartphone apps as opposed to from the telcos is because that is all active opt in, which is very different. So
like what kind of apps?
What kind of apps? So we work with a couple hundred different apps. One of our privacy protections is I don't know the names of the apps. Our suppliers scrub the name of the app and all other personally identifiable information when they send it to us, but I can tell you the types of apps. So one type of app would be an app that says, hey, congratulations, you took 10,000 steps. High five, right? Another type of app might say, be a weather app that says, oh, it's about to rain in an hour where you are, here's an alert. Another app might give you directions. Another app might tell you where the cheapest gas is. Another type of app, and this is a huge source, are dating apps that tell you when someone you've swiped on in a positive way is physically near you.
Never heard of these.
No? You know, everybody's just staring at it. Huge source of locational data. And then there's other lots of stores are trying to have a better customer experience. So if you have a physical retailer, they also have an app. And then they try to integrate with your in-store and out-of-store experience.
So like Bluetooth pings and the...
Yeah, or like, oh, you walked into the store, here's a coupon, that sort of thing. So there are lots of reasons that location is tracked. But a lot of those reasons are dumb, like to send you an advertisement. So a big thing that has happened recently, and it was official on January 1st, is the California Consumer Privacy Act. And so that changed, it sort of formalized... things that only the best practice people used to do, now you have to do it. And even though it's just California, it's very hard to implement a software just in California, so most software and apps are doing things nationwide. So what we've seen after is the apps that were following best practices, we only worked with them in the first place. We have very strict standards. We have a review you have to go through to show your privacy practices, all that kind of stuff. Our apps and our partner apps barely changed after CCPA. And some other folks who had been trying to sell us data where the apps were a little lazier about privacy, they're all gone. Because if listeners in America, you may have noticed in the past 3 months, as people get ready, your phone is sending you a ton more alerts that's like, hey, this app's tracking you in the background. Are you still okay with that? And websites are starting to pop up at you, especially starting January 1st, 2020, saying, hey, our privacy policies have changed. Please review. That is all around the implementation of CCPA. And it's really improving the hygiene of the industry overall.
Are those going to keep coming up, or is that you have to do it for the month of January 2020?
Basically, for the month of January 2020 in America, like what happened with GDPR a few years ago, every website you go to will send you things.
Happy New Year from every brand you've ever used. Also, by the way, we've updated our privacy.
Yep. Yeah. And there's like an argument that reduces the effectiveness. But really, it's about in an ongoing way. When you go to new websites, it'll become part of your whole process and get new apps.
Yeah. And then as court cases are decided and as the law evolves, then expect more of those updates.
Yeah.
Or when someone comes up with craftier language,
yep,
there'll be updates that just go across the industry.
But we do see CCPA is changing things in our landscape. And that means it's doing something for now. But it's for regulators to keep up with this industry, you need to be as technically savvy as we are. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's interesting is everything when we're talking about our licensing restrictions, which are very important, and CCPA, those apply when people follow the rules. There's a whole other set of concerns that happen when people don't follow the rules. For example, if an agency had individualized trip traces, which we would not have sold, but many of our competitors have sold, and they get hacked or ransomware, as we all know has happened to several state and city DOTs.
It's not that hard to get a city or a state or a federal agency to find one person that'll click.
Right. And honestly, it's not like tech companies are infinitely more virtuous. We just tend to have a little more money to put around those security questions. Mm-hmm. And also, as we saw recently in a New York Times article, when an employee of one of the data companies, in violation of their contract and licenses, takes that data and gives it to a press person, that is a whole different set of privacy questions. Because you can write the rules to be really well done, as I think CCPA was really well done, but then what happens if somebody cheats or if somebody hacks? Mm-hmm. And that brings you into a whole other set of investments you need to make to protect data. Mm-hmm.
We had an interesting conversation at Transportation Camp about what we called the Bradley Cooper problem.
Yes.
Could you unpack that for folks?
Yes. So.
Capital B.
Yes.
Capital C.
So basically.
Greg's grinning a lot right now. He's like really excited about Bradley Cooper.
Yes. So at Streetlight, we call it the hacker ex-boyfriend problem. Yeah. And when I was actually a grad student at Berkeley and working on this technology. Yes, go Bears. You had to file a human subjects research protocol for this. And it's the same. Your worst case nightmare is as follows when you're like writing your scenario planning is somebody who's very technically able, so not your casual person, but somebody who really knows data and big data and computers, gets access to a huge array of locational data, but they don't care about the huge array. They're looking for someone, right? And in this case, when the New York Times did this with a whistleblowered sort of extracted set of data, they looked for Bradley Cooper. Whereas in our scenarios, you like have somebody looking for an ex or somebody else they really don't like. And they were able to, by knowing a few things about Bradley Cooper, because he had done some public appearances, they were able to figure out which of the traces was Bradley Cooper. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you're stalking a less famous person, but you know where their kid goes to school, where they live, there's been papers out of MIT that says, if you have the world of everyone and you're looking for one person and you know a few things about that one person, you can usually find them. Right? So that's what the New York Times did with Bradley Cooper. Mm-hmm. And so the question on that is, it gets into a lot of deep philosophical questions. Mm-hmm. One is, what is privacy risk? And what are people really concerned about with location, right? Is it concerning to you that someone will know where you went historically? And is it concerning to you that anyone will know where you went historically, or one person in particular? So there's some interesting privacy, when the UK was using big data, they talked about, if you have an OD matrix and you show there was zero trips from one origin to one destination, that itself is a privacy regulation, because if some person told their spouse they had gone from that place to the other place.
Hey, sorry, I'm late. I was just at,
right.
Was
and then
the
spouse was actually a transportation planner who really understood this data, that would violate the other spouse's privacy, right? Mm-hmm. So you really have to ask what risk you're optimizing to protect. Mm-hmm. And the Bradley Cooper problem, I think, really, when I talk to people about this, they're like, oh, the government could track me, or like terrorism or political stuff. Most of the worst case scenarios we think about are very personal.
Mm-hmm.
which is different than I think what a lot of people think about when they think of privacy risk.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting, and one thing that you touched on before we started talking about Bradley Cooper. Fantastic.
We can
actor.
Do all day.
Yeah. He's so versatile, right?
I know. Yeah, he can sing.
A Star is Born. I cry.
A Star is Born.
On a plane,
my God.
No matter who's watching it.
I cry just thinking about
Anyways,
it. Yeah.
Going back to the issue at hand, you know, you were very careful in your words when you talked about issues like anonymization and de-identification. And the analogy that I've been using is cybersecurity.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who says you can be 100% cyber secure, you know, walk out of the room because they don't know what they're talking about. And I think this Bradley Cooper concept is pulling out something that I've been interested in doing a little bit of research on, is the everything that comes around geolocation data. And well, I hope we start to see more conversation around privacy impact assessments as we're developing mobility frameworks. And, you know, when you're in LA or San Francisco, it's probably going to be harder to track somebody. But when you're in, you know, Omaha, Nebraska, when you're in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and you might even then geofence a micromobility program, it seems like you're just making it easier and increasing the risk for potential re-identification.
Totally. So in the Streetlight Insight application, we've thought about this too, because we cover the whole U.S. and Canada. So if you've ever used it, there's this thing that happens where you pick your zones, and a lot of people will say, oh, well, how small can my zone be? And I'm like, well, if it's busy, it can be an off-ramp or a parking lot. But if it's a ranch that has one family that lives on it, you can't do it. So people always think, they're like, oh, how granular can you get? I'm like, it's not about spatial granularity. To maintain appropriate privacy sample sizing, you can push on the spatial granularity, the temporal granularity, or like temporal, like 4 to 5 p.m. versus 4 to 8 p.m., or like how many days in a year you analyze. And so we have, I just call it the exclamation point. I'm sure we have a formal name for it. If you ask the system for an analytic that hits that threshold, it will send you back an exclamation point. But if you're in rural Arkansas, you could have tried to pull like 8 acres and you'll get an exclamation point. Whereas if you're on my apartment building in downtown Oakland, where I live, it's one parcel, but, you know, 500 people live in my building, so you can analyze that building. So you're correct, and we were able to build a technical system that adapts, but I think that as these standards come out, they need to have that same thinking.
Yeah, and I think that's what's fascinating around the whole discussion around collection of mobility data and standards and what's right and what's wrong. But, I mean, one thing that, you know, we've been working on as part of a couple of different work streams is, you know, what are these foundational issues we need to start thinking about? And, I mean, it sounds like this conversation, hopefully you agree, like bringing up the word privacy, you know, shouldn't get eye rolls and everyone's like, oh, it's just a cop out.
Yeah.
You know, and both the public and private sector should be more invested in getting this right.
Yeah. I will say, more often when we are in the process of selling a data subscription, a data license to a government agency, we have the opposite trust problem more though, which is somebody like me, a PhD planner, will be like, I need to see the raw stuff. And that is still, you see this differential conversation at different levels of buying too, when we're talking about like what it takes to survive as a B2G business to government tech startup. We still see this emphatic emphasis on wanting to like see the raw data themselves. So I think there's still also a lot of education to go on the full stack of where privacy steps in.
Could you perhaps, let's go to the why.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we need this data? And what do
you... Yeah, we all know I need data. What do you need? I'm more data. Why?
Yeah. Great question.
And a lot of the positive
I don't know. I haven't seen the data yet. But the data will tell me what to do.
So, and that's the other thing about privacy, which is people are like, oh, well, this data could be misused, so it shouldn't exist. You're like, right, it's powerful. Which means, like all powerful things, it can do good and it can do ill. So it is our job as professionals to focus on the good and make sure that happens most of the time. So what does it do? So as I said, Streetlight Data has been around for over 8 years now. We have hundreds of clients. We have been used for infrastructure planning and prioritization in almost every city in the United States and most of the Canadian ones too. So like the uptake of big data in transportation, we're really beyond the initial curve and we're into like whatever the second wave of adoption.
Can you give like an actual, like, because we hear like, I need the data to be able to plan. Give me just like even a ball, like it doesn't have to be a specific town and project, but like we're doing this big bridge project. We use this type of data to determine X about a project. Like,
all right, we have three types of projects.
Okay.
The first type of project is the agency knew they needed to collect data, had a data collection budget, and uses big data instead of something traditional. So for example, One city in California put in some new bike lanes. Beautiful, complete streets. Yay. They're about to pass in City Hall another set of new bike lanes, and a bunch of people showed up and were yelling about how the bike lanes made it impossible to drive through town, and also maybe there were strangers in their bike lanes, and all these questions. And so the staff had a subscription to Streetlight Insight and was able to go in and say, okay, I can go back, I can look at biking and travel time before the old bike lanes and after the bike lanes, and I can show that, in fact, travel time has not been impacted for cars, and lots of local people use the bike lanes. So that is a replacement use case where they could have, if they had had some foresight,
put a counter,
had a floating car drive up and down. But instead, because of big data, they were able to do it for cheap, less money, but also like in 2 days before the next city council meeting. So that's a classic use case where we all know why we need data. Big data just makes it faster, cheaper, and more available. So that's one set of use cases. The next set of use cases are when clients realize that because they have so much data, they can do a better job at something than ever before. So an example of that is big picture infrastructure triage, infrastructure investment triage. So every state or MPO knows that everyone wants limited resources to do their infrastructure investment prioritization, and you have to make the list, and it's very hard, and it gets very political, and it's good that people are like, oh, we should have data to help us decide. So one of the ways we've been used in the state of Virginia, among many other places, but we're in DC right now, so good to mention, is thinking about what does the data tell us about getting the biggest bang for our buck, right? So if you were going to dole out, we'll stay in the world of bike lanes, $10 million for bike lanes, if you put them to try to displace cars where all the cars are driving 25 miles, probably no one is going to ride 25 miles on their bike. But if you can scan every road segment in Northern Virginia, as we did, and identify the road segments where a lot of car trips are maybe on the highway, but it's only a 2 mile car trip, that could be a good big bang for your buck situation. So that's another type of case study where just the massiveness of the big data enables better government practices. A third type of use case is when, because of big data, you can tackle these very new challenges that our agencies and consulting firms are facing. So good example of that was recently, this one, the report is all public, in Santa Clara in California. They had this really cool grant from CEC to develop a plan to support vehicle electrification, but to make sure all Santa Clarans had access to vehicle electrification, not just the rich people who could afford a Tesla on their own, right? Because why would you spend state money? They already have their Tesla. So it's a really cool concept, right? And that's the kind of new progressive thinking we want. That's the type of plan we want our government to make. But it's very hard to answer those questions. So one of the questions was, okay, we'll put state-sponsored charging stations where lots of people park, but the people are local and they're medium income, not high income, but they're not at home because maybe they'll have their own charging station and they have at least 20 miles left in their day to drive, so they might need to recharge. And it would also be convenient for local delivery vans and. It's a lot of ands. And it would seem like an overwhelming project, but we were able to set up a dashboard where you just click those six things and you're like, ah, if you care about those six things, these are the five places. If you care about all 10 of the things, you have fewer options. But if you relax this constraint, then you've got 14 options. And that's the type of new use case when data can really help progressive, interesting planning and transportation infrastructure ideas.
Wow. Are we able to, another use case is trying to understand who your users are, not necessarily the individual, but are we able to be pulling data when you've got a bus full of people? And over time, seeing, as there's changes in ridership, you can see whether or not there are, you're losing lower or higher income folks, or what neighborhoods people, what are losing from, not just from a route, but from the actual riders. Is that something that are you using, or are transit agencies using you guys as well as kind of a digital travel survey?
Yes and no. So digital travel survey is certainly something that we get used for. Our assumption when I started Streetlight was that bus is the thing that does have data about itself. I've realized now that I've been in the industry a little longer that that was an incorrect assumption. Some bus agencies have amazing data and some don't. So we haven't focused on bus analytics. Right now we do car, truck, bike, ped, and gig, which is like Uber, Lyft, Postmates, all that together. So with buses, we've done a lot of interesting, what I'd call market share studies, where the bus knows that ridership is going down, but they don't know why, right? So we're able to say, okay, who are people who are traveling the bus's route who are not taking the bus? So we analyze the other side. And then we can say, oh, it's like a lot of high-income people, a lot of low-income people. It's a lot of people who are traveling the bus route, except they're like going a mile further. So maybe just if there was an extra stop, we can prioritize that route. So that's what we've been doing with a lot of bus analytics. We also have a lot of clients who are coming from the private toll road industry, who are very interested in their users, or public-private partnership toll road industry, their users versus alternate routes, which is an interesting sort of counterfactual in when you really have a very explicit business motivation to get people on your road.
Huh. Is it? I mean, and this is an interesting question. I mean, obviously, we continue to talk about equity in shared mobility and thinking about how do we make sure we're reaching underserved populations. Then you want it, a lot of communities want this demographic information. Mm-hmm. But then turning it back to privacy, I think we then need to understand this is very sensitive information too. So there's a lot, I love your power analogy versus risk and how we could go down the wrong road. And I mean, you can probably talk a little bit more about some of the concerns just around census data.
Yeah.
Right.
So we use census or census-like data, updated census data, ACS data all the time. And one of the nice things about how it's published is it's already aggregate. So if we were analyzing a device that I carry, we would not, Streetlight would append my census block demographics to it, but we would not get me right? Because I would be a probability distribution function. So if I was trying to target advertising, that's not very useful. But if I'm just trying to understand the aggregate of travel of Oakland-based tourists in Washington, D.C., which there are a lot of this week, like that would be adequate. So part of it is in smart aggregation, and it's called privacy by design. Like you only get the data you need. You don't just get all the data and then figure out what you need later. You think very hard. But the other thing that sometimes I get this question that frustrates me, people are like, oh, well, your data has a lot of smartphones, so it must be economically biased.
Yeah, I was gonna ask about that.
No.
Yeah.
Everyone has a smartphone. We see one of the things we've been asked to analyze and don't is where the homeless hang out at night, because homeless people have smartphones because it's their primary compute device. And one of the things that I feel very strongly about is, especially with these new concerns around the census, what is very biased are traditional surveys. Because they've always been biased, right? Always native English speakers and older people have been more likely to answer a survey. But with the new concern about government-based surveys, that bias is getting even sharper. So smartphone-based data is actually far more representative demographically than any of our traditional techniques.
What is the ownership rate?
102% for the United States, I believe, because some people have more than one.
Well, yeah, and that was a fact that came out in the Carpenter case.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that influenced how the court decided is everybody has one. Some people have two cell phones. It was amazing.
Like, so then why are cities like so focused on that from the mobility providers? That,
well, having a smartphone, you are more likely to have a smartphone than you are to be banked, by which I mean to have access to digital payments. Mm-hmm. So I think a city that did a little research, it is valid to have a digital payment concern. Not so valid to have the smartphone concern. But sometimes those two things get conflated. But what's been interesting, if you look at Africa and other places, the telcos in those countries became payment systems. Mm-hmm. So there's like banks within your SIM card in other countries.
Oh, that's amazing.
Which is the way they dealt with that problem. But I don't know. There are some things that I get asked every time I go pitch a client that I still don't know. It's the power of marketing. Like, certain things get into the zeitgeist, and it's just very hard to displace it from people's minds.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we're getting close to our time here. I think it's been an interesting discussion, and I think we would all appreciate having you back. But what trends around data are you going to be tracking for 2020?
So one trend, I think, is the cooling off period after the AV data mania of the last few years. Like, we're finally able to not just talk about AVs, which is glorious. Because, I mean, AVs are clearly important, but, like, everything else is important, too.
Right.
Another trend that I see spiking is concerns about safety and using some of this data to promote not just traditional planning, but safety planning, as we've all seen increases in death rates in transportation, or you could say erasing of the gains we've made for the past 20 years in death rates. So I see that coming up a lot, especially with elected officials, and how do we use this to improve safety? And I think the other trend we'll see is, I do think we'll see a consolidation of big data supply because of CCPA. And we've already seen some of the app aggregators buying up the other app aggregators pretty much as a result.
And just to build off of that, the CCPA discussion, I think, is going to be interesting. And, you know, a part of that now gives citizens a right more rights around their data, right? One of the tough issues to get around when you said your privacy was violated is you couldn't show damages. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you were breached, but unless somebody went and hacked and used your credit card, you couldn't put a value upon your privacy. So I think that's an interesting trend moving towards GDPR and CCPA is we're starting to see more value. But do you think that's going to lead to more awareness? And are people going to actually, you know, contact a company and say, erase me?
So some people will.
Okay.
The other thing is, despite what CCPA is, it's very hard to do. It's very hard to pull off.
Yeah.
So when people talk to me about this, people are like, oh yeah, well, I opted out of everything. I'm like, you should behave as if you didn't. Like, to actually opt out of everything, you need to not have a smartphone.
Yeah.
Because no matter what you do with all your apps, Android or iOS, whichever one it is, and your telco still have all this data and can still get hacked and can still monetize the data. And like, so you should not think you've opted out, even if you've taken a lot of efforts to opt out.
Plus, you're still pinging cell towers. You're
yes,
still
exactly.
Bluetooth, yeah.
So if you're going to go murder someone, leave your phone at home.
There goes my flip phone. So that's not even going to
yeah,
help.
Even your flip phone. Post. Leave that yeah. phone at home. So first of all, you should do everything you can to make yourself comfortable and then still act. Just be cautious.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I think gets lost in the conversation a lot is that you are getting value from this data.
Right.
The value of my smartphone is, and all the apps on it is not the whatever $150, $200 combined monthly app fees and AT&T bill that I pay, right? The value of my phone to me is vastly, vastly higher. And the reason that so many apps are free or very low cost is because I am the product, right? So if we... I caught people like, oh, you know, consumers should get value from this. I'm like, they do. It's just, it's sort of weirdly hidden.
Right.
Because that's
the way you traded off your privacy as to subsidize whatever.
And so we could require all apps to have a paid version that has no tracking. That's one path that it could go down.
Right.
And then see if people are willing to make the trade. But I've also seen this interesting new trend on websites where, like, you log into a website and then something will pop up and it'll say, hey, I noticed you have an ad blocker. Just so you know, ads are the way that we are able to make this free for you, so can you please turn it off? And so I wonder if things like that will all start to emerge in locational data too.
I got one question. So if you've got all of this, why are cities going to the mattresses against mobility providers demanding, because we have to have this information, otherwise how could we possibly know what's going on our streets?
That's a great question. So some of it is power, because it's tied to being able to regulate and monetize these new mobility things. So that's part of it. But I think the other reason is that it is assumed that to track where all the Ubers and Lyfts are going, you have to get data from Uber and Lyft, but you don't. Like, we have had pretty decently validated metrics around tracking in aggregate gig driving, and it doesn't tell the city absolutely everything they want to know
doesn't
about
tell
the gigs.
Them necessarily whether it's an Uber or a Lyft,
exactly,
which is not necessary for planning.
Right,
it's necessary for other things.
Right. Also, the planners would really like to know the occupancy of the vehicles, which we can't yet do. So, like, there's some legitimate questions, but we can ask.
Which even Uber doesn't always know.
No. But also, we could answer, like, 60% of the questions without waiting for, and then we pick on Uber and Lyft, but there's plenty of companies to pick on. So I think it's a little bit of our job to educate people that you don't have to wait for them to share to answer some of your questions. But I also, frankly, think it's aftershocks of the roughness of the initial launch of ride hailing, right? It was an aggressive first few years, and the cities are not overreacting. They're being extremely cautious about the next wave.
Well, actually, one more follow-up on that. If you're selling this data to cities, why should Uber or Lyft not? Like, it clearly has a value, a dollar value that cities pay for. Why should Uber and Lyft, A, not be selling it to you, to the city, rather than, you know, and I guess the flip side is that what is the city's right to, like, I have a right to that data because you're using the streets. But also, why can't they turn around and say that Streetlight actually, all of that data was collected by people utilizing our right of way, and therefore we have a right to that data that you must, you know, share via MDS.
It's a big question. It gets into these deep philosophical things about what is private transportation and what is public transportation and what is commercial transportation. Because one of the arguments, so I don't know the answer to your question, is the short answer.
It was slightly rhetorical.
But, also, people say, like, oh, it's a commercial operator using our streets. I'm like, that's true. And so is every delivery vehicle that, like, brings the bread to the sandwich shop every morning
and pays that's the been gas op- tax
that has been operating forever. Yeah. So I think we have to be very cautious as an industry to not lose a bunch of lawsuits that have already started to like define why. Right. And to say, OK, we are going to ask for this data from the ride hailing companies, but also delivery trucks, double parking have been a urban scourge for decades. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to use this also as an opportunity to start tackling that problem. Like that would be more legally consistent to my mind.
Well, there's a difference between asking for something and mandating it as part of a permit, too.
Right.
Well, yeah, and I mean, even taking a step back from that conversation, I think even talking with Kara mm-hmm. and part of the standards work that I've been involved in, it's, you know, we never asked a question why, and we never developed the right use cases. And, and to your point, the data might be someplace else. So how do we figure out where the data already is and what's the new data that we don't know that might actually be productive and lead to all the good things we've been talking about? And then how do we evaluate the risks based on the right use cases that are identified? I mean, it's that whole let's be practical in our approach, which is easier said than done.
It is. And I agree. And that's like the privacy by design philosophy, which is design your question and then just get the minimum data you need to answer the question, which is, I think, another way of what you've, another framing of what you've been saying.
Yeah.
But still, I have said this to city agencies who are like, yeah, but we're not, we just need the data. We need to play around with it to figure it out. And I'm just like, maybe that would be best from certain perspectives, but what are you willing to give up in terms of privacy for your citizens to get that?
Well, and like you can come up with some pretty scary use cases by a government agency that we've forgiven all of that. And you know, and it's what you're seeing, some of the stuff going on these days, like with ICE, stops making it a, oh, that's a red herring hypothetical, because if you start combining some of these things, you like there's like it goes beyond, oh, I'm Bradley Cooper and I don't want, you know, Greg stalking me to like, no, I don't want to have been forced to turn over this information that is now being taken in by ICE and is being used to deport a family member.
Yeah. But I do think, I mean, I should have said when you asked what the data trend was, the data trend is everyone wants to talk about privacy all of a sudden, which is a good fundamental trend.
Right.
But the other thing I tend to bring up is privacy is important and it is a crisis, and climate change is a bigger crisis.
Yeah.
And we need to be very clear what we're willing to trade off. And it's not that just by using big data, a city will all of a sudden become climate neutral, obviously. But we need every tool in our belt to combat the impact that transportation is having on the climate. And data is a really powerful tool. So we need to be very clear about what we're willing to give up in some of these privacy questions.
I would love to see the data used to more definitively stop people from saying, I'm going to solve the congestion on route whatever by widening route whatever.
We are trying to do those things. And then the other sort of deep one is like, oh, well, climate will get better if there's less traffic jams. I'm like, I don't know. But
depends on how we got there.
Yes, but I will say academics get free access to Streetlight Insight if they're doing a research project that complies with our mission. So if you wanted to research the impact on climate impact of widening highways, come talk to me, email our academic hotline and do the research.
Leads to I think our final question: where can people find you online?
So the best place to learn about Streetlight
data, I didn't go online. Privacy nightmare.
I do feel when those things pop up on my phone and they're like, can it track you in the background? I'm like, just not to be a hypocrite, I need to say yes to everything. Yeah. So streetlightdata.com has all the information, not just about sort of the sales information, but also if you go to the resources tab, deep white papers that reveal all of our methodology very transparently, all the validation studies that have been done, and lots of fun use cases. I just gave a few. So that's the best place to find out about Streetlight. And I have done most of my social media posting actually on LinkedIn via the Streetlight account and my account. We find that more than Twitter is most of where our audience hangs out. Cool. But the Streetlight Twitter account is cool too. And we have lots of fun pics from TRB of like awkward parties with a bunch of transportation nerds.
Excellent.
Gotta hope those were anonymous.
Now I'm going to be looking through them. Pete, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Shared Mobility S.
This is Greg Rodriguez, also on Twitter at Smarter Transpo.
Excellent. And I'm Greg Rogers at AV Greg R. Find the Mobility Podcast on Twitter at Mobility Podcast, and stay tuned for more fantastic episodes from TRB.
This was awesome.
Thank you
so much. I really enjoyed it.